please. We're going to have a work session on Senate Bill 208. Who is here representing the board? Okay, we are going to have some invited testimony in the work session. Would you come up, please? Senator Berger, did you have a question of the board of naturopaths?
It says that you can obtain a temporary permit if you're practicing in Oregon less than 15 days in a calendar year. How did that come about?
For the record, my name is Ann Walsh. I'm the executive director for the Board of Naturopathic Examiners. That came around because there's a school located here in Portland, National College, and for instructors to come from Arizona or another state for with licensure to, to actually provide education in the clinical setting, they have to have a license in Oregon to treat a patient. And so what this allows is a practitioner in Arizona, say, to come into Oregon and treat in the educational setting patients to the students of the college.
I see. Let me clarify. So there's a naturopath in Arizona, and they are licensed in Arizona. They have a practice in Arizona, and they're going to come and lecture in Oregon, but they're going to use patients as a part of that educational lecture. And they would not be able to do that unless they had a temporary permit in Oregon.
Currently, the statute requires anybody who treats, diagnoses, and treats a person in Oregon to have a license as a naturopathic physician. This allows them to not meet those requirements, but to temporarily come in with their legitimate license in Arizona to
Last question. Yes. So if they're going to be in Oregon longer than a two-week period of time, that doesn't work. So that also limits for you, that for the board, that limits how long that they can be in Oregon and what they can do. I guess I have a final question. Give me some type of explanation of how you do an educational lecture and you're treating a patient.
Senator Morris, that's Senator Berger. I am not a naturopath, but my understanding is when the school brings in doctors who are educated in specific clinical treatments and protocols, they need to, as in any hospital or educational environment, be able to have a patient come into the setting, make a diagnosis of the problems that are seen, the symptoms that are presented, and then provide a treatment. And as part of our protection of citizens in Oregon, we require everybody who does that to have a license. So this allows somebody who's doing it for educational purposes only to come in with a valid license in a recognized jurisdiction to come in and do that for a short period of time.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sure you can understand that that is a little strange in that doctors come from all over, everywhere in the United States and lecture, and they're not required to be licensed in the state of Oregon. They come in for conferences and so forth. So that would be an unusual kind of thing to me.
But they don't, Mr. Yes. Chair, but they actually don't treat the patient if they come over, truly it.
So the difference is that if they lecture, they don't need the license, but if they do any treatment in
Correct.
Terms of instructional treatment, they do need a license.
Correct.
That's the rationale. Okay, any other questions? Thank you. Okay, we are in a work session.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 208.
Senator Cruz moves the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 208. Any comments, concerns? Seeing none. So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 208 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 208 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Would you call the roll, please?
Senator George?
Excuse.
Senator Montanahan?
Yes.
Senator Berger?
Aye.
Senator Cruz?
Aye.
Chair
Morrissette? Aye. Senate Bill 208, having received the constitutional majority, does pass to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And did you want to carry the bill?
No, Lori does.
Lori will carry the bill.
Okay.
I got burned off today, Bill.
Okay. Senator Mona Sanderson will carry the bill. Thank you. Okay, we're going to have, where are we? We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 754. Mara, would you come up, please? Mary Lou, would you also come up? Yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Maura Roach, and I represent the National Association of Social Workers, and we're here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 754, which would create a tax credit on educational loans for social workers. With me here today is Stacy Scala Orr, the Executive Director of the National Association of Social Workers, who will share with us why we think this bill is really important, and urge your support.
Chair Morissette and committee members of the committee, for the record, my name is Stacy Scala Orr, and I am the Executive Director of the National Association of Social Workers, Oregon Chapter. We are a statewide organization representing 1,700 social work practitioners, researchers, faculty, and students. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on behalf of SB 754, a bill which we support because of its capacity to recruit and retain social workers in Oregon's communities. Social workers often enter the field because they want to give back, to enter public service, often they're found in many settings and anywhere from adoption to geriatrics and everything in between. And in order, though, to finance their educational programs, because of the increased cost of higher education, social workers are often relying on student loans to finance their education, resulting in increasing student loan debt as they exit their educational programs and enter the field. This presents a number of challenges because of our notorious low-paying field. In the handout that I've brought with me today, on the second page is a graph of median or average salaries based on 2004 data from the U.S. Department of Labor Labor Statistics. And as you can see, social workers are at the low end compared to other professions that have similar or in some cases less educational requirements for that profession. The National Association of Social Workers in 2004 conducted a study assuring the sufficiency of a frontline workforce, a national study of licensed social workers. And out of their four key findings, two which I believe relate to the bill that we are testifying on behalf are one, that social workers are significantly older than the U.S. civilian labor force, and that two, the geographic distribution of social workers is uneven, resulting in gaps in access for those in rural areas. So this bill addresses both of these issues. One is in the recruitment recruitment of future social workers, we are facing a workforce shortage. This is particularly of concern with our older baby boomer generation, and social workers are often found at the front line to work with these and other populations. So this bill would provide an incentive in terms of recruitment. Also in terms of rural areas, as it's written, the tax credit would be highest for social workers practicing in rural areas. And on page 3 of the handout that I submitted, on the back page is a survey, some survey findings of a survey we did locally in Oregon of our members, our own members, and current social work students. Many responded positively to the notion of a tax credit in terms of as an incentive to stay in the field and also to practice in rural areas. Also, in our findings, just to give you an idea of the amount of student loan debt faced by social workers compared to their relative salaries, 78% of those that we surveyed either borrowed or anticipate borrowing more than $20,000. And more than 25% of survey respondents said they had borrowed or anticipated borrowing $40,000 or more. And again, at the master's level compared to other professions, then we exit, you know, into the field and face a median salary of approximately $35,000. So many social workers often leave the field. They're not able to sort of attain even middle class status, to be homeowners, for example. And they often leave the field for that reason. So we see this as an effective tool for not only the recruitment, as mentioned, but the retention of social workers in our communities. Thank you.
And just to clarify, so the way this would work is there'd be the way the bill's currently structured, a $3,000 a year tax credit for social workers working in counties of less than 10,000, $2,000 a year for those working in counties with populations of between 10 and 100,000, and $1,000 a year for those working in counties with populations of $100,000 or more. And this would apply to social workers who are employed by public or nonprofit entities who serve children, adults, families, or seniors who are eligible for public benefits like Medicaid, food stamps, foster care, domestic violence assistance, or other public benefit programs. So the number of areas for which this applies is narrow, and it has a greater benefit for those who are working rurally. It would not apply for people who are working in any sort of a private for-profit setting.
Any questions?
Comment. I work with social workers, and you don't know how I want to begin on record how valuable you are to Oregon. And I worked primarily with social workers through the Healthy Start program, and I always was appalled at the salary that social workers get, because they, being a nurse, we did the medical care, but doing all of the case management, the coordination, the crisis intervention that was required in high needs families, their job is really needed in this state, and I just needed to say thank you for being who you are.
Sir. Yes, Senator Cruz.
I just want to make sure that I didn't misunderstand, because you're talking about public body or nonprofit, and I understand that part, but then you gave a list and children, adults, families, but you know, I'm assuming this would also include people with disabilities. I mean, the whole gamut.
Yeah. Sorry, that was just an example.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Go ahead. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mary Lou Brophy, and I am here in support of this bill also, but I represent a different part of the mental health professional organization. I'm representing the Coalition for Consumer Protection and Choice in Mental Health. We are the licensed marriage family therapist, the licensed professional counselors in the state, and so my support would be with the proviso that this bill also include those two groups of mental health professionals. I agree with Senator Motis Anderson. I'm always part of a treatment team, and working with social workers, we're trained slightly differently, but we're trained equally. And we have people also very ill paid, and the student loan debt they incur for not only the going to school part, but the fact that postgraduate, most of them work 2 years for no money in a variety of internship positions under supervision, but getting the experience, the skills they need, that is the 2 years after they get the master's degree. So in that time, they accumulate quite a bit of debt, and we have people I know that are LPCs and LMFTs who owe as much as $40,000, all for the sake of education. And so I certainly understand the need for this bill, and I think it would be a wise reinforcement of Oregon's prioritizing these days of mental health care. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I guess just the response to that is, and this session, Mr. Chair, I have seen some of the tightest relating clauses that I've ever seen. And I'm sure it's all on purpose, but this one is relating tax credits on educational loans for social workers. So that is pretty narrow. So the ability to add any other discipline in this bill, we couldn't do just because of the tightness of the relating clause.
Senator Cruz, is it not possible for there to be an amendment? Because I'm trying to create greater unity.
And I understand that. But the point is that a relating clause for anything in the bill, to anything to be added to the bill, has to be germane to the relating clause. And because this is specific to social workers, in this bill you couldn't add another discipline.
That's standard procedure for drafting a bill, and it makes it difficult to add things to a bill if the relating clause is very narrow, and that's the reason why it's very narrow, so people won't say, gee, I want to be in on that. So that
is thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand. Thank you, Senator Cruz. The issue is, however, something that I wanted to bring to your attention.
Good. Good.
And I certainly support the social workers in this.
Good.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I was just pointing out the reality of this bill.
I understand, Senator Cruz. Thank you.
Okay. With that, I will close the public. Well, before we close the public hearing, let me talk a little bit before we get into a possible work session about the possible fiscal impact. As the bill is written, the ballpark fiscal impact would be $1.9 million first biennium, $1.4, $3.3, and in 9/11, $2.1. Why does it vary that way?
It's broken up 1 year, 1 year.
Oh, okay. 1 year, 1 year, and then biennium. I see. Okay. This is a workforce bill, and there's little difference in my mind between a tax credit and a appropriation from the general fund. They both in some ways detract from the federal or from the budget, the general fund. We tend to give tax credits oftentimes for workforce issues that focus on areas of need. Areas meaning geographic areas of need. Now, this bill will go, if we move it out, to the Revenue Committee, and I understand that you may have some amendments that you would introduce while it's in the Revenue Committee. Is that true?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. So that would mitigate perhaps a lot of the fiscal impact that we're seeing right here. So the question is, okay, we will close the public hearing. Do we want to open a work session?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I was wondering regarding the
let me open a work session.
I wanted to know about the I think, I forget which one of you said that there is a shortage of social workers. I was trying to read it.
Mr. Chair and Senator Mont Anderson, yes, I referred to it was a national study, so just drawing on the findings from that. It was conducted in 2005, and one key finding was that social workers are significantly older than the U.S. civilian labor force, and I believe the actual figure that I'm looking at, sorry, I don't have copies of it, shows that social workers are significantly more likely to be an older age group than the U.S. civilian labor force. There are a higher percentage of social workers ages 45 to 54.
My question was follow up.
Yes.
My question was, are there social worker slots that can't be filled? And usually the employment department has stats. We get these lists of where there's actually shortage, and that's what we base our allied health. And I'm not sure social workers fit into allied health, but in a sense, if they're dealing with mentally ill, they should be. But and so that's why I was actually saying, do we have a shortage of social workers to fill positions that are open now, like we do in the medical field?
And I don't have that specific data. I can certainly get that for you. But the projection was especially looking at our aging demographics and the amount of, because we're an older profession compared to the general U.S. civilian labor force, that is certainly the projection. I don't know where it stands at this time in the state of Oregon, but given the aging demographic of our own profession versus the aging demographics as well, but compared just the general U.S. civilian labor force, that a lot of social workers are aging out, and we need to be able to bringing in and recruiting social workers to fill the positions that those social workers will be soon leaving.
Okay, thank you. Senator Cruz has a question.
Just curiosity, we're going to move this bill. I would be interested in knowing what you are going to suggest as an amendment in revenue.
Well, I think there's a couple of factors. We've just tried to work through some of the math assumptions that were even just in the original fiscal around the 4% number, which we think might be a little bit high. Then also trying to look at the number of folks who would be eligible to take the full tax credit, because you can only take it against the liability that you have, and not everybody's going to be at the maximum amount, and making sure that the assumptions that were being used to generate this projection were actually accurate. And then beyond that, I think we would need to look at potentially reducing the amount in each category or eliminating a category or making some sort of adjustments that would bring the math down, and I think it's just going to take us a little bit of time to work through all of that.
Okay. I'm trying to, is that policy?
The Revenue Committee will, what you're saying, asking is the Revenue Committee should be considering the revenue aspect, but,
right.
Okay.
Ms. Chair, in response to Senator Monis Anderson, I guess from my perspective, if we move the bill to revenue, we are saying that we think the policy decision of giving tax credits to social workers is a good policy option. Just by moving the bill, I think we're making that statement. My concern at this point, I mean, if I knew, we just moved a bill the other day to revenue and sent it out of Senator Walker's committee with two amendments, because it was a revenue decision on what the impacts of the two were. So we sent it without recommendation with the dash 2 and 3 amendments attached to the bill, quite simply because we liked the policy, but that decision and what Mara's talking about is clearly issues that the Revenue Committee is going to have to wrestle with as they're looking at the myriad of tax credit bills they have down there. So,
good, excellent point. So maybe we should wait until you come up with an amendment, the amendment.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure. They got to run numbers at this point, and that gets into the jurisdiction of the Revenue Committee and Paul Warner to actually do the hard count, which they probably won't necessarily do until they have the bill, I would think. I mean, we could get Paul to do that for us, but part of the reason we did what we did in the Senate Ed Committee was because at this time of the year, Paul Warner's office is somewhat busy, and we didn't want to intercede into the body of work that they are doing with both revenue committees at this point in time, and so we moved it so that they could address it in a way that fit in with that discussion.
My concern would be if we send it with the idea they would do the amendments, it wouldn't happen. I'm concerned that, well, I think if you would be better off if you brought the amendments to us and then we sent the bill with some choices that they could make rather than them having to start from scratch. And I think it would take less time for you to get the amendments back to us. We could look at them and send some choices to revenue, just as you said.
Or if they have a decision they have made on the changes they want to make, and it was something we thought appropriate, then we could send it with a recommendation rather than.
Okay.
I just get concerned that we're going to send it to revenue and they're not going to do anything with it.
Yeah, that would be my concern.
Okay.
Knowing what's happening in revenue.
It would be easy for them to say, well, gee, there are no recommendations. We have to figure it out, so let's forget it, because they are very busy. And if you come back to us with the amendments, we can then send a recommendation to revenue, and they are more likely, I think, to act upon it.
Mr. Chair, Do you think that we can get the recommendations, like, within a few days of the amendments?
If we ask for them.
Yes. Right.
I mean, I would assume so.
No, I think that we as a committee will ask for an expedited amendment that will come back to us, and at least it will have something for the revenue committee to consider, and we can make a recommendation, and I think that would be the quickest way to go. So with that, we will close the work session without having acted. Yeah, good. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Good. Thank you. Yes, indeed. Okay, we are on, oh boy, Senate Bill 170. That's what we've been waiting for. All right. Yes, explain the bill so everybody understands it.
Senate Bill 170 allows the Board of Massage Therapists to discipline or deny licensure to persons who aid, abet, or assist an unlicensed person to practice massage, updates requirements for students performing massage under supervision of the instructor, allows the board or authorized representative to inspect premises where massage is done. Also allows the board to issue temporary licenses. The committee does have before them the -1 amendment, which restores human in the definition of massage. Also clarifies any person licensed by an Oregon state regulatory body who is acting within the scope of that license when practicing massage is exempt from the regulatory authority of the board. Excuse me. Also do want to, for the record, the committee has before them two submitted written testimony, one from Jeff Davis, Chair of the Continuing Education and Extended Learning Program at Lane County Community College, in opposition. Also one from Kimberly Metzler, a massage therapist student at Lane County Community College, in opposition. And also one from Stephanie Martinez. She's from Massage Now Learning Institute and is in support of Senate Bill 170.
Okay, thank you. Patty Glenn, would you like to bring?
Sure, I'd like to bring our attorney, Assistant Attorney General Lori Lindley, and our board member.
Sure. Good. Thank you. Good way to start. Okay, would you introduce yourself for the record, please, Patty?
Senator Morissette, Patty Glenn, Executive Director, Oregon Board of Massage Therapists.
Senator Morissette and Jordan Barton, professional member of the Oregon Board.
Okay.
Chair Morissette and the committee, Lori Lindley, Assistant Attorney General at the Department of Justice.
Oh, very good. Thank you. Patty, did you want to?
You know, we're here at your disposal. This has been, as I summarized in a very late last-minute explanation for you, once we were aware of some of the opposition concerns that have been circulating via email, a long process that the board has gone through. This committee was first named by the board in October of 2004, a rules review committee, to take a comprehensive look at both our statutes and rules and make sure that what was in statute and rule is still current with the profession and the change and things that have changed over the last decade, but also to address or assure that there wasn't any inconsistencies between statute and rule. These recommendations to the board came from that committee and went through many different iterations, both at the committee level and also at in several board meetings until you got the final product, which became concept and sits in front of you, Senate Bill 170. We did, with the committee's support, put forward a Dash 1 amendment to address two concerns that came up after the bill was already drafted, one adding human back in, and the second one to slightly amend the language of the first exemption piece.
Okay. Any questions, comments? Okay. Who wants to go? Are you here just for informational backup? Is that right? Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Good. Thank you. And you can step down and we will...
Well, I think I would like to ask some questions.
Absolutely.
This bill will extend the authority of the board over the policy and ethics of massage schools in Oregon, which already are in compliance with the Oregon Department of Ed.
And that is not correct, Senator. Okay. I apologize for that. It's a misunderstanding, and unfortunately we haven't had the opportunity to address the individuals or to even know who the individuals were that were behind some of the concerns that were raised via the email communication. So addition of the word program simply addresses the fact that many of the massage schools here in Oregon have a massage program as a whole. So rather than currently, the Department of Ed, and they will retain that authority, approves the schools and the programs and oversees the function of the school. But as part of their oversight, the board actually reviews the curriculum and approves the curriculum. So rather than having certified individual classes, we can approve the whole program for those schools that have an entire program and not a class-by-class curriculum.
And then the second concern was that this bill might interfere with the rights of state and private massage schools to maintain existing contracts with employees.
We've looked at that a million different ways, Senator Anderson and members of the committee, Senator Morissette, and I can't find any way where that could ever cause that to be the case.
Is that the complaint about privacy of a client who is on a table being massaged, and when you have a surprise inspection, is that the complaint you were referring to?
No.
Senator Montes Anderson?
No.
Or is that a different privacy complaint?
Senator Morissette, members of the committee, a different privacy concern.
Okay.
That issue has to do with our random inspections. And a previous Attorney General opinion on this matter had indicated that since we have the authority to name a complaint in our own name and we can do site inspections upon complaint, that the board could do it upon a complaint of another or in its own name. Within the field of massage, we're getting more regular complaints of issues regarding hygiene, linen practices, and things which we have specific standards that the therapist must adhere to. And so as we're out in the field, or as our investigators are out in the field doing other investigative work, we would like to be able to also continue to do investigation work, or to go in and do a site inspection for the therapist in that community. We have had the case to do them in the past. We've had great feedback from the therapist that they appreciate knowing that, you know, they were supposed to have a lid on their trash can, or that their linens weren't supposed to be stored under the cleaning supplies. As I tried to outline in the explanation, the process is very tight in what we do right now. If we come into an establishment, even if it's on a significant complaint, unless there's imminent public harm, which we have not had that situation come up, we would wait until that facility was available or come back at another time if they had a client with them. In no case would we ever go into a treatment room where someone was being treated or interfere with that process.
Just another follow-up.
Yes.
Health facilities have to meet certain standards, and it is by rule. So I don't see any problem with the board taking some of this on, but I was a little bit surprised that you would want to have just inspections without having any complaints. That's number one. And then number two, have you had complaints from people or from Oregonians regarding massage therapy? the clinics, or
yes,
whatever you call them.
Mons Anderson, Senator Morissette. We have received several complaints regarding the quality of facilities, everything from linens being used multiple times for clients and being soiled when the clients got on the table, to issues of mold and mildew in the bathrooms, or no towels provided, or a what we would use in our homes as a bath towel being provided for the clients to use repeatedly, and we require by rule that they have single-use towels in a dispenser. Those are the types of complaints and concerns we typically get.
Okay. Did you have a response, sir?
Identify yourself. Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Jordan Barton, Senator Morissette, Senator Morris Anderson. I'm a professional member of the board. This particular site inspection piece clarifies language and doesn't change the actual scope of, scope of powers that the board has regarding, and over the last few years, it's my understanding the board has acted in a professional manner, both ethically as well as professionally in these inspections. So I just like to, as a professional member of the industry as well as a board member, express that to you. So.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Senator Berger.
Both of us.
Both of
One at a time, though. Senator Berger, you go first.
All right. One of the things that talked about is the courses and the study and the outline of what people are to study, and the board's authority by rule, which really takes away any other authority, which means that the board has the final say of exactly how that is. So in some regards, not just your group, but several groups that have come before us, it seems to me that boards want to have all authority and without oversight, and I think that's of some concern to me. You might want to comment on that.
Senator Berger, Senator Morissette, members of the committee, it depends on which state you're in. It seems right now, as I've been watching legislation in the massage arena across the country, how Senate's our legislatures feel about that issue. Some are much more likely to want to defer to a governor-appointed board or commission to take care of those issues that are specific to their profession, like education, and just name those parameters. And it sounds like there may be some concerns here today about allowing that to happen. We did look at that and realize that we had a mirror image in both statute and rule of the same exact information. And so as the committee reviewed that, felt like leaving the minimum hours as established by the board and rule, which was already clearly defined and established, maintained that consistency, but also allowed the board to address some nuance that may come up in the future where something needed to be added or changed. The statute is a minimum, so all of those listings are minimum content that has to be contained, and certainly the power of the board currently allows them to expand that. But again, I think this board has proven over the years to be very responsive and very connected to the profession and to the schools, and making sure that they're conducting themselves in an appropriate, responsible manner that assures public safety and doesn't exceed that authority or power. So.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Yeah, a specific question. Section 2, page 2, sub 2, lines 22 through 24 says, a person may not aid, abet, or assist another person who does not have an active massage therapist license issued under RS 687.051 to engage in or purport to engage in the practice of massage. I'm just wondering who a person is. For example, if I go in for a massage and I get the massage from somebody who does not have a license, but I would not necessarily have any way of knowing that, can the board take action against me? I mean, I'm wondering if this is taking you outside of allowing you to take action against people outside the scope of your profession.
Senator Morissette, Senator Cruz, the language in 2A, which is lines 22 through 24, was added. The addition of Section B, which is 25, line 25 and 26, which says the board shall issue a person violating paragraph A of the subsection 1 warning before taking any formal action. We've really wrestled as a committee and as a board with how to address that, knowing that they knowingly violated the law, and it's hard to know what someone, you know, knows. And so we wanted to assure that the lay public or someone wouldn't be, and so the first half, I guess, of my answer, that wouldn't be subject to sanction by the board who just simply wasn't aware of the rules and responsibilities in the state of Oregon. But the other more important piece of this is really geared towards addressing some of the really unscrupulous individuals we have, and we are starting to see that growing of spa owners or business owners who knowingly employ unlicensed individuals because they can employ them at a much lesser rate, and then having those individuals become eventually sanctioned by the board and dismissed, and only to replace them with another unknowing unlicensed individual. And at this point in time, except for addressing the advertising on behalf of unlicensed individuals, we have no authority to take action on those types of individuals. We also have some issues in the fair circuit as well as in the malls where business entities have come in and established kiosks or come into the fair circuit with untrained and unlicensed individuals. The owners of those the individuals paying for those establishments are very rarely on the premises, and again, those unlicensed individuals have ended up being sanctioned by this board, and the board not able to deal with those entities or individuals employing those people.
How are they sanctioned?
The unlicensed practice, yeah, yes, with, yeah, a civil penalty.
Enforceable by?
The board.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Okay, I guess maybe I understand what you're trying to get at. You don't want somebody opening a business and then hiring unlicensed people and purporting them to be massage therapists. I understand that. My question is, the way this is worded, it applies to everybody. And this is a person. That's the universe. Okay, that would mean that theoretically, if I went in to get a massage from an unlicensed therapist, I'm aiding and abetting their giving a massage because I'm getting it from them. So theoretically, you could take action against me for a violation the way this is worded, I believe. So.
After a warning to you, I think, unfortunately, with the language, you're correct. And we did work and rework this language to try and come up with something that allowed us to address all of the individual situations who may be of significance. I assure you that we don't have the time, energy, or desire to go after an individual who procured unlicensed services.
Well, Ms. Chair, I understand that, but the words do have meaning, and I guess... I guess I just have a slight concern that this, unless I'm not reading all of this accurately, but
Senator Berger.
Mr. Chair, you can actually take it further than that. I could recommend to Senator Cruz the name of a therapist under this language, and if he went, I have aided and abetted.
Well, it gets worse.
I think certainly, I'm sorry, not to interrupt, I apologize for that, but that's back to that piece of there would have to be a preponderance of evidence that indicated that person knowingly employed someone else who's unlicensed, and so I can't come up with a scenario where the board's ever taken action. And we've had previous cases of that type of a nature, and they've always resulted in allegations unfounded and the cases being dismissed, so I don't see that the board's history in prior cases would change any in the way we handle ourselves. And I don't know if our attorney would like to address.
Introduce yourself.
Sure. Lori Lindley from the Department of Justice, representing the board regularly on cases, Senator Cruz and Chair Morissette and committee. It is important to note that there is a sub B requirement in this, which requires anyone that the board believes to be violating that to receive a warning. So if, in fact, let's take your example to the nth degree, the board felt that as you going in and getting a massage were aiding and abetting, they wouldn't necessarily go after you. They would give you a warning, first of all. I highly doubt that they would actually give you a warning in that factual circumstance. To me, the words aiding, abetting, and assist mean knowingly and with some financial gain to that person involved in together with someone else doing something, and aiding, abetting, going for a massage to me doesn't actually equal that in my mind. I think maybe knowingly aiding, abetting was in there at one point, and right, we took that out and because there was a lot of wordsmithing, and I think that I don't recall the exact discussion on that. Maybe Patty has more information on that, but that is something to consider. That I think you have to keep in mind there has to be some broadness in the language to give the board the ability to do what they feel is harming the public, and some trust that the board's going to do the right thing in an appropriate manner.
And if that would appease the committee's concerns, then adding that word knowingly back in, because we're already giving them a warning, which indicates that we know that they now know what the rules and laws of the state of Oregon are. If adding that word knowingly in to A helps to address those concerns, of course we would certainly do that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, and did you have another question?
I do.
Okay, go ahead and answer.
All right, I guess the thing that bothers me the most about this is the responsibility should be on the massage therapist or the person that is operating illegally or without the proper license and so forth, and not on people that are going to that person or a person that's recommending that person. This language, I know that you mean well, but this language is language in there that says what it says. And I would be, you may get a warning, but then you may have to go to some problem of defending yourself to prove that you didn't know anything about the therapist. So it seems to me that the responsibility is being placed in the wrong place. It should be on the person that's operating illegally.
And if I may, Senator Morissette and Chair Morissette and Senator Berger, sometimes in our investigative information, we have found foreign, not English-speaking folks working in some of these large spas that really don't know that they have to be licensed. They're looking desperately for work. They see an ad in their local paper in their language. They go for the interview. They kind of become the victim. So in your sort of question, shouldn't we put this on the LMT's responsibility? These people really don't have the knowledge of the educational background to know that responsibility. And so those are the situations I think that this language was meant to try and protect from.
Mr. Chair, can I push back just a little bit on that? That's fine, except you have the warning system. So you say to the non-English-speaking person, this person, you now know and you need to get licensed or do whatever you need to do, and you've been warned and caught again. Maybe you'd want to include the person that hired them with this language, but I think the language is very broad.
Senator Berger, just a point of clarification. Chair Morissette, sorry. The unlicensed practice is a separate statute, and so those individuals are not subject to a warning. They're expected to know the laws in which they're practicing. And unfortunately, what we're finding is like Ms. Lindley indicated, that we have either lesser educated or foreign-speaking individuals who are told by an employer that they do not have to have anything more, that they are free to do what they're doing, and they come in under that faith that the employer is directing them and under some belief that the employer would be held accountable if the employer had directed them inappropriately or incorrectly. And then they end up getting sanctioned, and the employer is able to walk away and continue the business in the manner in which they were doing it. That was the intent of this language being added.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Myers Anderson.
I would be most comfortable with language where you say a person may not perform or engage in massage therapy, and leaving it at that. I would think that then those that you're, it wouldn't get at the owner hiring a non-license, which I think you're trying to get to. But at least you would have, to me, a person may not perform unless they're licensed. Then you have the warning system. And so give me feedback on why you wouldn't want to go that route.
Well, we currently, Senator Monis Anderson and Chair Morissette, we currently have language that allows us to go after folks that are practicing unlicensed. So I don't know, this kind of opens up a policy question for the board, and I'm not the board. Does the board want to have to give every unlicensed person a warning now? I mean, that's a whole different subject. And I don't know that the board wants to do that.
I thought that was the intent to.
This is only for the folks that are aiding and abetting the unlicensed practices. This only go to the folks that rent the kiosk in the mall in Eugene, that have those people that do the hand massage, and the people at the fair that pay the money for the table that have the unlicensed massage, and the chiropractor who may hire three or four unlicensed LMTs because he can pay them cheaper than he can pay a licensed LMT. It's those kind of scenarios.
Thank you.
Senator Cruz.
I understand Senator Berger's point and don't disagree with it. I guess I still get back to this whole a person. What you're wanting to go after is the employer.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. So why don't you?
Or the business owner.
So why don't you call it that instead of a person? I know this is Scrivener's issues to a large degree here, but I guess I'm wondering why we aren't naming who it is. You're really targeting.
The person language came as a recommendation from Legislative Council as to what the statutory definition of person was, seemed to encompass the span of entities we were talking about. That's where that particular word happened to come from. This piece of the bill is not so significant to this board that I would want to see this hold it up. We are seeing an increasing instance of this, but we're talking truly about maybe a handful of cases in any given year that might fit into the scenario. And certainly, not to dismiss this, but I would much rather strike this piece from the bill and move forward than to have this be of significant concern to this committee or amend it.
Okay. And Ms. Chair, I'm not impugning anybody's intentions in this at all. I just know that words are words, and over time, different people come in and interpret, and different things can happen. That's just standard, and also, if we're too broad in the language we put in statute, it gives maybe more flexibility for rule than we might have initially intended. So,
well, I would make an observation that this is the Full Employment Act for the legislature to keep tweaking, and we're never going to get it perfect. So we do the best we can, and then wait until next time. If there's a complaint that we can fix, we fix it. So I don't know that we're going to get perfection. We're going to have to move along, and there are a number of other people, but don't go far.
Thank you.
Because the next person, Rose Jade, would you come up, please? Rose, thank you. Sorry. Introduce yourself, please.
My name is Rose Jade, and I'm here on my own behalf. I am a Chair Morissette and other members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I am a longtime client of licensed massage. I'm currently studying massage at Lane Community College. I have a background in science. I have a Bachelor's of Science, and I'm also a lawyer. I also teach at University of Oregon in the PPPM department in public policy, planning public policy and management from time to time. I've given a little bit of attention to looking at this bill. It came to my attention as I was studying professional practices at Lane Community College, and it generated quite a bit of dispute among the faculty and the students there, and I decided to go through it line by line, and I have some written testimony here. I have 20 copies that I'm prepared to give you, and I would like to say that, I'm familiar with housekeeping fixes in the legislature. I have no problem. But the vast majority of this bill goes way beyond housekeeping fixes. And I have set out in my written testimony detailed opposition to it, most of which has been already covered by questions from you, which I appreciate. But just to highlight, I believe the bill deprives licensed massage therapists and their clients of their rights to privacy and the presumption of innocence. Licensed massage therapists have to pay attention not only to the statutes but to the OARs that this board issues. And we do pay attention. I mean, I pay attention as a student, and I know all the LMTs that I know personally pay a great deal of attention. And I think that, due in large part to the 500 hours minimum of training that we have to have, we should be given the presumption that we are following the law and be respected. I think I'm especially concerned with the unannounced, what they are calling inspections. Currently, there's a complaint-driven process that triggers an investigation. They send out investigators that are performing, you know, frankly, quasi-law enforcement activities. This will trigger Fourth Amendment and Article 1, Section 9 issues under the Oregon Constitution as far as unreasonable search and seizure. Many masseuses practice in their own homes that they share with other people. Not everyone practices in a salon. Often these are domestic situations where the client is assured total privacy and that they're not going to be interrupted by strangers. Doors are locked. If someone comes and knocks at the door insistently, that causes an interruption in the session. I also share the concern. I'll just go down my little points here, and then I'll leave my testimony to you. But I also believe it strips the legislature and massage school administrators of their current powers and accountability pertaining to the education of prospective and licensed massage therapists. For instance, Lane Community College not only offers courses to prospective therapists, but also offers continuing education to licensed LMTs. I believe the bill will conflict with existing contracts and state and federal constitutional provisions that are relied upon by public school teachers, administrators, employers. I also think it will conflict with those provisions for business contractors between landlords, for instance, and other business associates of LMTs. It basically authorizes the board to act as a full-on criminal law enforcement agency with very unlimited discretion to impose fees and penalties and do so without any meaningful oversight. I have yet to see any empirical basis supporting the need for these drastic changes. I believe the board will use its expanded power under this bill to micromanage state and public school programs, state school employees, students and clients. There's been a lot of concern about so-called fraternization between LMTs and adult students at certain schools, which I think has been blown way out of proportion. I also think that there's a reasonable, foreseeable risk that the board will use its powers to impose hefty civil fines on unsuspecting third-party businesses and health practitioners in order to generate revenue for the board and its employees. These fines go directly into the board's account. They do not go into the general fund for the state. And this creates a real conflict of interest as far as I'm concerned. And I know you're pressed for time, and so I'll just submit my testimony. I have included a proposed amendment. I didn't get it to Legislative Council in time, but I did try and follow the format, and I've attached that that would basically delete all the provisions that I'm unhappy with and leave a few housekeeping provisions. Do you have any questions?
Not at this time, but we may have.
Okay, I'll stay in the room. Should I go ahead and give this to the clerk?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Well, I think we have it, unless you have something that we... Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I don't have a question, but my question in the opening of the hearing about the powers of the board... I have that as a very serious concern, and but I also have seen that in other groups that have come before the body, and it worries me. I think that there should be oversight, and I think that in this case, the board is the final, absolutely the final answer, and also the oversight into the education program. I think there's some real concerns here.
Diana Knott, Heather Bruni, no, that's not it. Heather, Diana, come up, please. Cindy, would you also come up here? We're going to have to be fairly brief, but go ahead. Why don't you go ahead?
I'm Diana Knott. I am one of three investigators for the Oregon Board of Massage Therapists, the only one that is actually not a member of law enforcement, whereas the other two are. I was particularly pleased with the aiding and abetting language that had come about with our committee. As an investigator, it's our responsibility to go in, be an impartial party. We're to collect facts. We provide that information to the board. The board makes that decision. It had been becoming increasingly heartbreaking to come across, and it was particularly foreign individuals who had not known what the laws were. They trusted somebody else to tell them what they were and to know what was going on. They would then be sanctioned by the board and go through their process, whereas the owner of the facility would then bring on new people. The intent is to create something that would actually make those individuals care to stop breaking the law. At this point, we have no authority to go after them. There's nothing that I can do. There's nothing that the board can do other than watch as they essentially throw these people under the bus time and time again. I understand that there's some verbiage concern, but I would hope that the concern on the language wouldn't get lost in what the intent of that particular piece is.
Thank you. Questions?
No, I would agree. It's I just, you know, we're dealing with a problem. I would just kind of prefer that we focus where the problem is a little bit more, if that's possible.
Thank you.
Yeah. Senator Morissette, members of the committee, my name is Heather Benori. I'm a licensed massage therapist, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Massage Therapists Association, which is a group of licensed massage therapists. We provide educational networking and different resource opportunities for massage therapists in the state of Oregon. I went through and contacted as much of our membership as I could reach by phone. Those that I spoke to were in support of this bill. Their overwhelming concern, if there was one negative concern about the board, is that they are not doing enough at this time to regulate unlicensed practice. There have been multiple cases where people have reported vendors working at fairs and they're unlicensed. The first step that they have taken, since those usually occur on weekends, is going to the director of the fair, who says, well, it doesn't affect me and I don't care. And there's no repercussion or enforcement of having a licensed person there. We definitely approve of the aid, abet, and assist if it does need to be modified in a manner that reflects language that you would approve of. I believe we, as an organization, would also support that. And speaking on behalf as one of the members of their executive committee, we also approve of the education moving to statute, moving to rule. Things that have come up in terms of scientific studies, as we learn more about how massage affects human physiology, as new diseases come about, even if you just think of AIDS in the late 80s and early 90s, how those things need to be incorporated into educational programs in a timely manner so that therapists can be educated and treat those people appropriately, I think is critical, rather than having to wait for a future legislative session to break down, now you need 4 hours in this new disease education. We do approve of the language, and I'm here to support this bill. Thank you.
I see statutory language more as a framework than the details. The details have to be worked out by rule, and the legislature is an oversight body that will respond to rule changes on an as-need basis if there is a complaint. But we can't get into great detail. We have to leave the flexibility to rule. Other comments?
Chair, to a degree I agree with you, and I really have, excuse me again, I really have no problem with the majority of the bill. There's just a word there that bothers me.
And I don't have a problem with that either. I mean, I don't have a problem with the fact that you have a problem. And if we can agree on a fix, that would be great.
I'm going to leave that one alone.
Okay. So why don't you...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I represent the American Massage Therapy Association of Oregon. It's the largest professional association in Oregon and works collectively with other states in our nation to try to bring the regulations and standards for massage therapy up to a degree of respectability so that we can come into these forums and talk to you all and tell you the best way to help us help our public. I want you to understand first and foremost that the public was given the opportunity to participate. The Board of Massage Therapy has always been very good about posting notices, getting people involved. We were very involved in these changes. We do, in fact, consider them technical changes. And I'm sure that in some of the hearings you've had most recently, you've had your regulatory board and your association that they're overseeing or the profession they're overseeing come here and clash heads. There's no clashing here. We get along famously. We respect each other, and we think that we're both working to the betterment of massage therapy for the public in Oregon. So we did work collectively on this. We have no problem with inspections, A to bet. We follow the rules, so it's not a problem for us. Same with my smaller association to my left, which is also just as active. We don't have a problem because we don't do these things wrong. However, that being said, if you would like before your public hearing and work session that I'm sure you want to schedule, I'd be happy to sit down and help the Board of Massage Therapy with legislative counsel and anyone else who wants to participate to come up with the correct words under the aid and abet statute that will solve some of the difficulties. Any other language you think needs work, although I got the sense that was really the only sticking piece. The rest, you've seen some emails, you've seen some complaints about particular sections. There's five in particular that have been sent to you, and I have answers to every darn one of them, but I won't bother you with them here. I'd love to talk to each individually if it is that you think those five concerns need some kind of rebuttal.
Yes,
sure.
Yeah,
Senator
Cruz. Thank you, Cindy. Aid and abet, I don't mind. It's a person. I support where you're going. I support, you know, I remember, you know, you go back 20 years and what massage meant and what massage means today in the state. It's a significant improvement.
Mr. Chair, do you mean a person in Section 2, Sub 2?
Yeah.
Well, what else would it be? A business? Because not all of us are actually businesses. Some of us are
business
sole
or
practitioners.
An employer. Well, Cindy, what we heard was that what they were after was people that are employing non-licensed people is who they're trying to get after.
Actually, it's interesting, Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, because the word employing, in that case, I think maybe using would be a better word, because at some state fairs, you have friends coming and perhaps helping to give a massage when you get overloaded, and it's not someone you're actually employing. And I think that's why we left it a loose term as a person, because then we grab all those folks. I think it's the sub B of two that makes it very clear that we're talking about a person who's licensed to do massage, aiding and abetting others who are not licensed from doing it. I think the sub B is what clarifies the context of 2A. Because the Board of Massage Therapy, Senator, only has control and only can have a say or reprimand over those under its licensing statute. Well, so they're saying that here, if you violate this, then you get a formal action taken against you, in this case a reprimand, and they can only bring formal action against people for whom they have license control over.
Okay. Well, if Senator Cruz is going to carry this bill, I want him to be satisfied.
Okay.
Senator, I'm happy to either come up with the amendments that make you happy. We can sit in the office and do that, or convince you that this is good.
Let's talk, and if we can get this little thing fixed, I'd be happy to carry the bill.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I really appreciate when people go through all the hoops, get their license, have a respected profession, and see people just honing in on their profession in a way that they don't necessarily respect, and it's a problem. But I think you want to be very careful in the fact that you have a bill that is focused on your problem and bringing a solution. And I think that in this bill, a person bothers me a great deal. And I think that I know what you're trying to get at. I support what you're trying to get at, because I think that it's not fair to you. But the language is too broad. I also think that I have a concern about the board wanting final say, because there is some responsibility, if it's in rule, for a legislative oversight of some kind. And so it's not going to take much. Cindy, I welcome you to come in and visit with me so that we can, I have gotten a number of emails and kind of talk through it so that we're comfortable with it and better satisfied, and that I feel like it's focused right on what you want to accomplish, and I'd like to help you accomplish that.
Absolutely. Mr. Chair and Senator Verger, I will definitely come to your office and talk to you about this. And I have to say that I'm actually quite impressed that you're looking out for the professions and not just looking out for the regulatory boards, because I think in the past that has been a way of working here at the legislature, that your purview was more of the regulatory boards, since they're supposed to protect the public. I'm happy to see you looking out for the profession as well, and as the representative of that profession, I will certainly help to make this what you need it to be.
Thank you.
Michael, would you come up, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, Michael had to leave. He is the secretary of, he is the government chair of AMTA Oregon, and now the secretary as well, and he was involved in the process and agreed with it. He just wanted
so
to know.
So I will then close the public hearing.
Thank you.
I'd like
one more comment.
Oh, okay, go ahead. We'll allow that. I will open the public hearing very briefly for another comment.
I just
introduce
have one,
yourself, please.
This is Rose Jade again, and I thank you very much, Chair Morissette, for letting me step back in here. But I had forgotten something that I wanted to say in response to something Patty Glenn had said, which was an inference that the Attorney General had given her an opinion that they could go ahead and do these unannounced inspections, or leading one to infer that. I had a follow-up conversation with her the other day about that. It was not what, as a lawyer, you would understand to be an attorney general opinion. She told me it was an oral statement stated to her by an assistant attorney general who no longer works for the attorney general's office. So I just wanted to clarify for you that there is no written attorney general opinion authorizing unannounced inspections. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. We will reclose the public hearing. Okay, Senate Bill 326. We will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 326.
Senate Bill 326 creates the Orthotics and Prosthetics Board of Examiners within the Oregon Health Licensing Agency. It requires that persons who practice orthotics be licensed, appropriate certain fees to the Oregon Health Licensing Agency account for use of the board. I'd like to make sure that the members of the committee know you did receive the -1 amendments. The -2 amendments have been, substitute for that. They're both gotten stuff amendments. The Oregon Advocacy Center has been working with the Oregon Health Licensing Agency and other stakeholders to develop a set of amendments which all the parties agree on. And it's my understanding that we'll get from testimony some additional conceptual amendments for the committee to think about.
Okay, thank you. We're going to hear the next bill before the committee before we leave here at 5, and so we're going to have to kind of move things along. So Tracy, would you come up, please?
Okay, start.
Okay. I'm sorry. Nikki, would you come up, please?
Yes.
Okay. I'm sorry, Tracy. I just... Nikki, come.
Do you want to go last?
Who would you like to bring with you?
Chair Morissette, I have with us our client from the Oregon Advocacy Center. I have -2s here for the committee to look at.
The 2s?
Yes.
Okay.
Good. Okay. Thank you. I have our client, Oregon Advocacy Center.
Why don't you sit down and introduce yourself, please?
Get comfortable.
Yeah.
Get comfortable. May I drop this off for you?
You bet.
Thank you.
Okay. Very good.
And I want to hear her actually pronounce these words properly, so...
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Nikki Terzieff, Chair Morissette. Thank you, members of the committee. I have with us today our client from the Oregon Advocacy Center, Bob Jundiff, and a couple of folks, real-life Oregonians, who'd like to share with you their story about why the creation of this board is so important. May I invite them up, please?
Yes.
Thank you.
Ms. Chair, first she's got to pronounce those two words.
Oh, orthotists and prosthetists.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll come back to those words. So, there will be other conceptual amendments probably. Right? Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundiff. I'm the director of the Oregon Advocacy Center, and as you've already heard, I'm used to stumbling over the word advocacy as well as many other people. That's why this bill has presented a particular challenge for us in pronouncing orthotist and prosthetist. But one thing I can tell you is that just like people rely upon the fact that the attorneys who work in my office are licensed and regulated by the state bar, and that those clients can, when they have a problem with the performance of our duties, can go to the Bar Association to have their concerns aired, investigated, and resolved. So too do individuals who need the services of the fine professionals who do the orthotist and prosthetic work. Those individuals would like to have an opportunity to have some assurance that the people who are serving them have met certain minimum requirements to perform these duties, their professional duties, and that should they have a problem in terms of the service, that they have a reasonable way to bring that problem to a body that's skilled in investigating and resolving the particular problem. And that's why we have the bill today. And to my left are two individuals who can speak directly to the problems that can arise. I'd like to start off by introducing my far left, Alice Plimel. And I've worked with Alice for years. She's an attorney, and we are both on the Oregon State Bar's disability law section. And and I'll leave it to Alice.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Alice Plimel from Eugene, Oregon. I have worn a prosthetic device, namely an artificial right leg, for approximately 55 years. 15 to 20 years ago, I started this horrible process of trying to get a new limb made. My limb maker had moved on elsewhere, so I had to find a new limb maker. I went through 6 different limb makers before I finally got a limb that I could walk on. I had nowhere to turn to. I would contact a limb maker and tell them of my problems and tell them I was extremely hard to fit. Oh, I can do it. I can do it. There's no problem. Only to have a limb made and that I could not walk on. One of the problems in this area is the limb makers are usually paid by the insurance company before or at the time the limb is completed. And if you go back to the insurance company later and say, well, this limb that you paid for, I cannot use, I cannot walk on, the insurance company will say, well, sorry, we paid for it. Now it's your responsibility to make them make it good. I've had this told to me by more than one insurance company representative. During the time I went through six different prosthetic makers, I suffered two severe falls that resulted in brain injuries. I was in the hospital the first time for a week. I was in the hospital the second time for 10 days. The second fall, I suffered permanent hearing loss, as well as my brain was actually moved by the fall. My insurance, my health expenses over and above my health insurance was $10,000. And finally, about a year ago, I found a limb maker who made me a limb. The limb actually works. The limb actually, I can actually stand up at the, for example, the closet and get clothes off of the rack without falling over backwards. I would tell the limb makers I was falling over backwards and saying, what is causing this? I don't know. I got so many I don't knows out of limb makers. It was incredible.
Thank you.
My name is Dale Driscoll, and I live in Eugene. I have a prosthesis I've had on for 8-9 years now. I only recently became aware that there was no licensing requirements or minimum requirements for a person to make the prosthesis. A cheap prosthesis is $12,000 in round numbers. Insurance companies many times only cover one and two maybe over a period of time. The first person that attempted to make a prosthesis for me, I wasn't satisfied with. It took forever, and it didn't fit. My doctor recommended another person. I went off to that one and have been relatively satisfied. I just think it's important that prosthesis makers are licensed, meet minimum requirements, and that there's some method that, for lack of better words, that I could get to them if I needed to. I didn't realize that litigation was the only method of dealing with the malfeasance, if you will. Other than that, I don't have much more to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you for being here. Warren Mays, Dave Barrows, would you come up, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Dave Barrows. I'm here today representing the Association of the folks who do this work. Mm-hmm. With me is Mr. Warren Mays, who's been in the business for more than 20 years, is an acknowledged expert, is certified nationally, and we're here today to indicate that we are supportive of this effort to move forward in licensure. Mr. Mays has a few comments, if he may, Mr. Chairman. We are committed to working with other parties to come to you with a final product. We're very close, okay. And we're down to just a matter of a handful of issues.
One word, person, right?
Pardon?
Person. Oh.
It's a little more than that, Mr. Chairman, but not a lot more. Thank you.
Chair Morissette and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today on Senate Bill 326. My name is Warren Mays, and I'm a certified prosthetist orthotist.
Wow.
My practice is located in Tualatin. I've been in practice for just less than 20 years. I'm here to testify today on behalf of the Oregon Orthotics and Prosthetics Association, otherwise known as OOPA. Okay. Prosthetics is the field of design and fitting of artificial limbs. Orthotics is the field of design and fitting of bracing of the spine and extremities. Collectively, Orthotics and prosthetics is a time-intensive, material and technology-laden profession. Not only is a thorough knowledge of anatomy and biomechanics involved, but it is also necessary to have a sensitivity to the patient's needs and their progressive realization that they in fact need and will have to use one of our devices, perhaps for the rest of their lives. The relationship between a patient and their prosthetist orthotist is unique in that they will work together for the patient's benefit for the rest of their lives. Prosthetists hear about the most intimate details of patients' experiences as an amputee and provide necessary emotional support. There are roughly 150 people in this state performing duties usually associated with prosthetics and orthotics. There may be another 50 to 75 or so people providing similar specific services, like providing knee orthoses or arch supports. Licensure is a natural progression in the effort to raise the standard of care that we provide. Several other states have also taken this step. My profession is unusual in that it evolved out of a rather craftsman-like trade and has only had formal educational training available for the last 40 years or so. In that light, a number of my colleagues have had little or no formal educational or experiential training to learn the basics of orthotic and prosthetic patient care. Further, as technology improves, prosthetics and orthotics professionals must expand their knowledge through continuing education. That is necessary to provide our patients with the latest concepts, parts, and pieces to be incorporated into the design of a limb or brace that will simplify or enhance their experience with their device. That is why we are here today, to discuss the need for a set of formal standards to make sure that each and every one of us practicing in the state of Oregon meets a minimum educational requirement in the hopes of ensuring a better patient experience with better patient outcomes. Interestingly, this licensure bill is not being put forth by the orthotic and prosthetic professionals, but by a consumer advocacy group. We, as a profession, have unsuccessfully tried three times in the past 30 years to become licensed here in Oregon, and only now do I feel that we actually have a chance of seeing this pass, due to the support of the Oregon Advocacy Center. While OOPA, as an organization of orthotics and prosthetics professionals, supports the concept of licensure, we do have concerns about some of the language in Senate Bill 326, amendments which we understand are being proposed to replace the original bill. We would like to outline our concerns and offer our professional expertise to work with the bill's proponents to develop language that reflects the work we do and to ensure that language in our licensure statute will be consistent with that of other health professionals. We believe that such a collaboration will create a stronger licensure bill. I'm not going to go into the concerns. You have it there in your readout there. I'm going to skip right to the end here in the interest of time. Again, I would like to voice OOPA's support of this licensure effort. As the professionals directly impacted by this legislation, we want to be active participants in the development of the licensing board for orthotics and prosthetics. We understand that it will be our licensure fees that support the board, and we want to be certain that the legislation to create the board reflects our knowledge of our profession. I would also like to reiterate my earlier offer to work with the proponents of the bill, the Oregon Advocacy Center, to create a board that reflects the work we do and to ensure that language in our licensure statute will be consistent with that of other health professionals. We believe that such collaboration will create a strong licensure law. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 326. I would be happy to answer any questions you may have for me.
Okay. Questions? Yes, Senator Bridger.
I guess I'm just so surprised that you have not been licensed. That just seems to me, and I'm just wondering, in years past, what has happened after all the fall that the lady described earlier can be a very terrible thing if you don't have the right fit. And the fall itself can be as bad as the injury that you had that makes you need the prosthesis.
Absolutely.
In serious circumstances like that, I guess it just is appalling to me. And I happen to be riding down the street in my hometown here in Oregon last weekend, and all of a sudden there was a little building that used to be a floral shop, and it's now prosthesis. And so that got my attention in that I looked and thought, well, that's interesting. I've never known them to have a place in my town. And so this has really gotten my attention now, because from what you're telling me is that you've also not been required to have any particular training. Is that, have I misunderstood that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger.
Not under Oregon law. There is a national license or a certification board, and that's the path that most of us choose to follow. I have a Bachelor of Science degree in orthotics and prosthetics. I have the highest degree that's available in this country. I spent thousands of dollars on my college education. I had to do 1 year each of residency for first orthotics and then another year of residency before I was eligible to test for prosthetics. I spent thousands and thousands of dollars to become certified by a national board. So those of us who choose to will follow that route. Medicare actually defines a prosthetist orthotist as a quote-unquote ABC, which is the American Board for Certification, an ABC certified practitioner. So most insurance companies, in my experience, require people to be certified just in order to be willing to pay for these things.
Well, I would think so. Follow up, Mr. Chair. Yes. I guess I just would like to make a comment, and that is the contrast of the ill-fitted prosthesis that causes an individual to fall. And then I'd like to cite the example of someone I know that has a prosthesis that is probably one of the best dancers on the dance floor. So there's quite a difference in the quality of life that people like you give to an individual who has to go through losing a part of their body to becoming just the same as everyone else. And that's a wonderful gift.
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, it is often a very gratifying experience to be able to provide someone with the opportunity to continue on with their life. And
absolutely.
Thank you.
Other comments?
Are you going to be able to get this together in the next week or so?
Mr. Chair, we are very hopeful.
Yeah.
And we had a meeting before the hearing today, mm-hmm. and the only caution I have in these things, having been around a couple of years here, is that I think the parties can come to a conclusion pretty quickly. I always put an asterisk on the answer, Mr. Chairman, because then we get a note from Alana, and then it goes to Legislative Council, and sometimes they come out in a timely manner, and sometimes they don't. As you know from your experience, Mr. Chairman, and both senators or chairs of committees have been. So, yes, the answer is very hopeful with that asterisk.
Okay. We are currently having this discussion about our timeline, which is Senate bills by the end of the month. We've heard this bill. The next question is there a time limit on when we get amendments and fiscals? There will be no fiscal on this?
Well, it goes to Ways and Means, Mr. Chairman, by a prior reference.
Okay, so the fiscal would be who's going to pay for the...
And that'll be done down there.
Okay, so... Well, I appreciate this happening because I have been working with another body that is not licensed in the state of Oregon, the surgical technicians, and I have been struggling mightily for the last three sessions to get them under some body. And the same thing is true. They're not licensed. Any person can be pulled off the floor and become a surgical technician, although there's a national certification, mm-hmm. just as in your case, which is the key. The nationally certified people will then qualify for the licensing. Yes. So I would really, really like to see this happen, and we will work very hard to make sure that we do have the time to hear, and we'll get the amendments and bring you back and make it happen.
Our goal, Mr. Chairman, is to have a 3-minute work session where we all sit here and say,
Kumbaya.
Kumbaya.
Yeah.
That was our goal. Very quickly.
Let's hope we all don't sit there and say, signee die first, right? No.
We are committed to having that not happen.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Tracy, Tom, would you please come up? We'll hear the other half. No, not the other half.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tracy Retton, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Physical Therapy Association. Mm-hmm. I'd like to start my testimony by thanking the proponents of this bill for their hard work, and also for addressing some of the concerns that we brought forward and being extremely open to cooperating and including us in their discussions. The concerns that we had brought forward are addressed in the Dash 2 amendments. If you look on page 5, line 7 of the bill, there's some exemption language. When the bill in its original form was brought to our attention, we reviewed it with our national association, the American Physical Therapy Association, and they brought to our attention some issues that had arisen in other states. Licensure of orthotics and prosthetics. I'm not going to use the other term, orthotists and prosthetists. We'll see if that's right. Has been occurring in many states in recent years. The American Physical Therapy Association, in their experience, has found that in some states, this has been used as a means to limit a physical therapist's ability to address issues surrounding orthotics and prosthetics in the treatment and interventions around physical therapy and rehabilitative services. So this is a concern of ours. I'm sure that you would understand that obviously there's overlaps in a lot of the scopes of practice, and we actually think that's good for consumers. It creates patient access or increases their access and choice to a variety of healthcare practitioners. And I'm sure it's of no surprise to you that a lot of the language that dictates these professions is very broad. And actually, it leads me to remember the hearing that we had in Senator Moses Anderson's committee on Senate Bill 135, which was dealing with the occupational therapists. Initially, the language they submitted to legislative council was a big laundry list of very detailed things that they do within their practice. Legislative council turned around and said, no, because that's going to just open you up to liability by listing out everything so specifically that you do, that if you do anything that's just right outside of that, you know, you're going to find yourself in trouble. So they kept their definition very broad and then left it to the rulemaking process to get into the details. So as you said, Senator Morissette, the framework was laid, and they would fill in the details with their rules. This leads us to our practice act, which is a very broad definition as well. It doesn't specifically speak to the work that we do with orthotics or prosthetics. However, it is something that's required by our education, something that physical therapists receive education in. We don't specialize in it, but it is something that is utilized within the practice. Our concern is just simply we do agree and support the intent and the licensure. We just want to ensure that since we are regulated by our own physical therapy licensing board, that this doesn't have an impact on our ability to practice within our own scope. I should also note that we spoke with the occupational therapist, and they shared a similar concern as well and have seen similar experiences. So we did include them as a specific exemption within the language. We are open to working with that language to make sure that all parties are happy with it, but our intent is that we be regulated by our own board and that our scope of practice is not infringed upon.
Yet?
Yes, I guess so. Thank you. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Tom?
Mr. Chairman, members, Tom Barrows, representing the Oregon Podiatric Medical Association. I also like to echo what Tracy said, thank the proponents for coming to us and working with us to try and get a bill that we can be happy with. The printed bill, as it was presented, had both an MD and a DPM, Doctor of Podiatric Medicine, as members of the board, but it had only one orthotist and one prosthetist. In the amendments that were made, they jumped each of those to two and took away a couple of other members. My understanding was that the OMA was fine with not including an MD on the board, and the podiatrist wanted to maintain that spot. I understand from the previous speakers they would like to see that changed. We would resist that change. The reason that podiatrists probably don't send referrals to those folks is because in a lot of cases they do it themselves, and so it would make sense to have that expertise on the board as well, although they would be in a minority in the total membership. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing right now, and you guys can go forth and do good and come back. Close the public hearing. Open a public hearing on. Pardon me? 2073A.
Are you going to read the...
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, House Bill 2073A renames the Interagency Coordinating Council on Hunger to the Interagency Council on Hunger and Homelessness and directs the council to serve as lead agency to deal with both hunger and homelessness.
Okay.
It updates state policies regarding hunger by redefining food security and creating a benchmark that Oregon will rank among the top 10 states in providing food security by 2015. The committee does have before them the -A2 amendment, which clarifies that the Hunger Relief Task Force must include a representative of the Oregon Food Bank.
Okay. Rick? Introduce yourself, please, and would you give us your age?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Rick Krager, Deputy Director for Oregon Housing Community Services, and 40 years of age today.
Oh, you're 40 years of age today.
Yes.
Oh, happy
Shall
birthday.
We say happy birthday?
How did I know that?
Mr. Chairman, I suspect I probably know, but...
Oh, no, you just are radiating birthday today. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, Mr. Chairman, you all look like you've had a long day here, and I've learned so much today in terms of massage therapy. And in the spirit of all that, you know, I wish I was a licensed massage therapist and I could come back and give you all a nice little
well,
massage.
Well, we would be aiding and abetting because we don't have a license. So
that's true. I am just a person. So, Mr. Chairman, thank you again, and I know I've had the opportunity to meet with all the committee members, but I am here today to present and support House Bill 2073, and I have provided you some written testimony, and in the spirit of time, I'm going to cut through some of that and just tell you House Bill 2073 changes the current Interagency Coordinating Council on Hunger to Interagency Coordinating Council on Hunger and Homelessness. It expands the council and include additional 6 state agencies. The total membership will increase to 15, which will represent a total of 13 state agencies. The council will receive recommendations from both the Hunger Relief Task Force that's already existing law and the newly established Ending Homelessness Advisory Council. And this was a council that was assigned through executive order by the governor last April 4th, because I recall it was on my birthday. So what a coincidence. Here we are 1 year later. By expanding the council's focus to both hunger and homelessness, it will benefit the people of Oregon by, one, allowing a more unified front to represent Oregon on matters of policy funding and discussions relating to food, nutrition, and homelessness, creating new opportunities to share resources, information, and collaboration among state agencies and between public and private organizations involved in the ending of hunger and homelessness, and finally expanding the ability to make recommendations to policymakers for better coordination of programs for hungry and homeless persons. In addition, Mr. Chairman, there's a few other language changes that we have in the bill. One is the definition of hunger is modified to reflect the definition that is used by all federal programs. We also, the membership of the existing Hunger Relief Task Force is expanded, and the functionality and structure of the task force is clarified, and Patty Whitney Wise, I know who was scheduled to testify after me, can address some of that. And finally, the role, the functions of the department for the Interagency Coordinating Council on Hunger and Hunger Relief Task Force is also clarified. I should just mention the -2 amendments that are in front of you. Again, as committee administrator has spoken to, is essentially changing the word statewide food bank to the Oregon Food Bank. This is the way it has always been in law. There was some changes that were made when we were doing some of the housekeeping, and it was changed to be broader, and our focus is to have the Oregon Food Bank as the representative on the Hunger Relief Task Force, as it always has been, so there's never intent to remove them. So we wanted to provide and come back and amend that just to clarify the specifics of that. Mr. Chairman, also there are no additional expenditures associated with this bill, finally it will help the department to do a better job in its quest to reduce hunger, increase food security, and to end homelessness in Oregon. We urge your support, and Mr. Chairman, happy to answer any questions you might have.
Questions? Why don't you stay right there, and Patty, would you come up, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Patty Whitney Wise with the Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force, and I'm glad to be here today in support of House Bill 2073. I've attached to my testimony our executive summary from the Act to End Hunger. This is the second executive summary that talks about the progress we've made in the first 2 years. The Interagency Coordinating Council on Hunger has been very instrumental in working with us on that, and we believe that this model is a really good one to expand to the issue of homelessness, and that there are a lot of interlinking issues. So we come before you in full support of this proposal, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Any questions?
I have lots of them.
Yes, would you? okay, would you ask Rick how old he is?
No, I would not do that because I wouldn't want him to ask me.
No, he wants you to ask him.
Rick, how old are you?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cruz, 29 years of age today. That's the right answer?
No, that you're under oath.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cruz, today is my 40th birthday.
Well, happy birthday.
Thank you, Senator. Appreciate that.
Doesn't buy you anything, but happy birthday anyway.
You almost committed perjury there. No questions. Thank you. We will.
What we're talking about.
Well, I'm not going to close the public hearing, open a work session.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I move the -2 amendments to House Bill 2073.
Okay.
A.
Senator Montesanto has moved the -2 amendments to 2073A.
Mr.
Discussion.
Chair.
Hearing no discussion. So moved.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2073A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Linus Anderson moves 2073 to the floor with a due pass, as amended, to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Call the roll, please.
Senator Linus Anderson?
Aye.
Senator Berger?
Aye.
Senator George?
Excuse.
Vice Chair Cruz?
I didn't have a chance to read the bill yet.
You're going to carry it, so you better hurry.
All right. Thank you.
Aye. Having received the constitutional majority, 2073 moves to the Senate with a due pass recommendation, and Senator Cruz will carry the bill. So you better read.
So you will find out about it.
We'll find out.
That'll
teach you to leave the room.
Well, that's
what happens when people leave the room. They come back and they find themselves carrying a bill. Happy birthday.
Thanks, sir.
Thank you. Okay, we will close the public hearing and stand adjourned. Thank you.